traditions of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to 3CR Thursday Breakfast, and I'm in the studio with Priya and Leela on the 7th of August. How are you both?
Good. Good morning. I can't believe it is the 7th of August.
Yes, the year is really flying by. Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Inez. Good morning, Leela. Sometimes, just thinking about the genocide, I can't believe the time hasn't stopped entirely. You know, it is kind of overwhelming to contend with the fact that we are still somehow moving through life when the world should have stopped. In a slightly lighter public service announcement, I saw a sweet darling riding their bike in front of me yesterday, nearly get tram tracked. And my recommendation is, first of all, probably try and avoid, you know, doing the cool thing of going across tram tracks when it's wet, because it's so easy to get stuck in the tracks if you've got thin tires. But if you are, I usually try and turn my front wheel so that it's as close to 90 degrees, so perpendicular to the tracks as possible, just to make sure that I am minimizing my risk of getting stuck in the tram tracks. So stay safe out there, guys. You never know if whoever is driving behind you is going to be able to brake in time if you fall off.
That is the lighter note, people.
That is the lighter note.
And wear your helmets.
Wear your helmets.
You're cool people listening to our show.
My gosh, there are so many people riding around. I'm like, is your helmet invisible? Mm. Are you invincible? I worry about your safety. All right, so we have a big full show as per usual, and starts off with a segment from 3CR's Yana Pasaran, a show that examines ethno-nationalism, white supremacy, and neo-fascism in so-called Australia, hosted by Andy Fleming and Cam Smith. And we're going to hear a conversation between authors Ariel Bogle and Cam Wilson speaking about their new book, Conspiracy Nation, and discussing some notable conspiracy theories emerging from the colonial legacies of settler culture on stolen land.
And after that, we are going to hear from Jay Coonan from the Anti-Poverty Centre about the Commonwealth Ombudsman report into maladministration of Centrelink's targeted compliance framework, also known as mutual obligations. The first report from the Ombudsman investigation found that failures within the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations, or DEWR, are responsible for the unlawful reduction and cancellation of Centrelink payments for thousands of people receiving income support. Jay Coonan works with the Anti-Poverty Centre to advocate for systemic change, ending conditional welfare such as Centrelink's mutual obligations program.
And then I'll provide an update for some anonymous submissions that we've received about the ongoing campaign against toll and how they drive genocide and offshore detention. And that will be kind of like a panel discussion as well.
Cool. And after that, we're going to be joined by Inner West local Monty Green to discuss the Footscray Community Response Campaign, which is fighting against a recent council decision to use bylaws to harass and displace homeless people in the city of Maribyrnong. And listeners may recall that we recently had Jorge Jorquera on to talk about the July 23rd decision by council members voting in favor of employing private security in response to local social and health concerns, despite widespread concerns from local residents. So to listen back to that interview and to all of our previous programming, you can head to 3cr.org.au/Thursday-breakfast. And finally.
And then we have Nicole or Tadpole MacIver, who is the captain and inaugural player for the Mount Alexander Falcons and have been in the team's leadership group since its inception in 2022. Now, Tadpole is passionate about AFL footy and even more passionate about community. And on Sunday, July 27th, that just passed, the Mount Alexander Falcons football team held a trans and gender diverse celebration game in Harcourt Regional Victoria. Initially organised as a response to the Riddles District Football Netball League, excluding trans netballers, the day was a joyful celebration of trans and gender diverse inclusion in sport, and we'll speak more to that in our interview. And Tadpole's also a presenter on the main FM show On The Wing. So an amazing, beautiful show, lots of different topics to cover, and we'll be right back with our headlines. Don't want to miss it.
The Victorian state government is planning repressive new laws to restrict protest, including bans on protective masks and lock-on devices, increased police search powers, restrictions on symbols of resistance such as flags, and creation of so-called safe zones around religious buildings, putting significant areas of the CBD off limits. We must say no to this attack on democracy. Protest is a fundamental human right. Join the fight to defend it at a mass rally hosted by Defend Dissent Coalition on Tuesday, 12th of August, 5:30 p.m. at Parliament House. Defend Dissent Coalition is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:07 in the morning, and these are the news headlines for Thursday, the 7th of August. Victoria police have been criticised for a heavy-handed show of force at the Sunday pro-Palestine protest in Narm, where officers in riot gear blocked thousands of peaceful demonstrators at the King Street Bridge without warning. Organisers say the blockade, which included mounted officers and armoured vehicles, left protesters feeling traumatised and targeted for simply exercising their right to protest. That same day, an estimated 300,000 people marched across the Sydney Harbour Bridge, raising questions about why NARM protesters face such intimidation. Protesters in their thousands across so-called Australia continue daily and weekly rallies, demanding the federal Labor government impose sanctions on Israel and stop the two-way arms trade.
Meanwhile, this week in Gaza and the West Bank, Palestinian authorities continue to record deaths and arrests of Palestinians at the hands of Israel, including starvation deaths caused by Israel's ongoing blockade of humanitarian aid. Israel has issued the latest forced displacement order for Palestinians living in northern Gaza, announcing a westward expansion of their genocidal operations and forcing residents to so-called safe zones in the south that are routinely attacked by Israeli forces. Discussions within the United Nations Security Council have this week referred to the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's push to occupy Gaza completely as deeply alarming and unacceptable provocation.
Also this week, a damning report released yesterday by the Commonwealth Ombudsman has revealed widespread unlawful Centrelink payment suspensions, with welfare recipients calling for immediate government intervention. The investigation into the targeted compliance framework found at least 1,000 payments were cancelled unlawfully, and nearly 350,000 suspensions were issued in the first quarter of 2025 alone. The Ombudsman has criticised the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations and Services Australia for systemic failures causing severe financial and emotional harm to welfare recipients. In response, the Anti-Poverty Centre and more than a dozen community organisations are demanding the government immediately stop the payment penalties and abolish the harmful compliance program. And we'll have more later in our program with Jay Coonan from Anti-Poverty Centre.
In other news, the Victorian Labor Party's state conference passed a resolution calling on the government to keep all land at NAHM's 44 public housing tower sites in public hands and to expand public housing. The move follows growing public pressure, including rallies over the weekend opposing the demolition of public housing towers and the sell-off of public land. Public housing tenants, activists, and elected representatives from the Greens and Socialist Alliance addressed protests over the weekend, opposing the biggest sell-off of public assets ever attempted by a government in so-called Australia.
And finally, in headlines, the United Nations Human Rights Committee has issued an urgent request for the Albanese government to halt the deportation of an Iraqi man to Nauru while it investigates potential human rights violations. The case highlights the potential human rights violations of Australia's offshore detention policy, with past detainees on Nauru having been killed and having suffered violence, medical neglect, and discrimination. This case is the first exercise of new third country deportation laws introduced in November 2024 in so-called Australia. Advocates are urging the government to uphold its international legal obligations and immediately suspend the planned deportations. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 7th of August, and you're listening to 3CR 855 AM.
Thanks so much. And I just wanted to bring attention to something that the Human Rights Law Centre has posted 2 days ago about the Australian Uyghur Women's Association have filed legal action against Kmart, pursuing documents to determine whether Kmart has misled its customers about forced labour in its supply chains. You can read more about it on the Human Rights Law Centre and Maurice Blackburn. But I think, yeah, important to bring that to the forefront as well, because it's part of one of our biggest, you know, Australian brands, and an important investigation. And alongside that, I know that we do Palestinian updates every headline, but I just wanted to also draw attention to Sudan as well, where currently the forced starvation is similar to people in Gaza, is getting to an absolutely horrific point, which it has been for a long time, in numbers that are so big, and where you can't really find a lot of press as well, and the information is hard to get. But currently right now there's also a large cholera outbreak in Darfur, which is only the August the 1st, and there's crisis in the camps, where there's actually been 2,719 cases of cholera and 49 deaths, and it continues to worsen displacement in Tawala, Jebel Mara and Nayala. And a lot of these children as well are under 5 years old, and Kamla Camp has reported a public health emergency. And I know it can feel really hopeless for a lot of the things that we talk about, or there's a lot of things to pay attention to. But even like many hands make light work, and there's even if it's a continued practice to support, I think that's a beautiful thing to practice. So yeah, we'll be right back with the next part of our segment.
Panoply, panorama, panpipe, pansy, aha, pansexual, knowing no boundaries of sex or gender. Sound interesting? Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan. All those gender questions making you think too hard? Whether it's transgender, bisexual, polyamorous or beyond, we'll throw those questions into the pan and cook up the answers for you. So go on, push that gender envelope. Only on 3CR 855am digital and 3cr.org.au. Let's cook, 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 cook. Let's cook.
Let's eat. Let's eat.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855am, and it's just about to hit 7:15 in the morning. Now, we hear a segment from 3CR's show Yena Pasaran, which examines ethno-nationalism, white supremacy and neo-fascism in so-called Australia, and is hosted by Andy Fleming and Cam Smith. In this conversation, authors Ariel Bogle and Cam Wilson speak about their new book, Conspiracy Nation, and discuss some notable conspiracy theories emerging from the colonial legacies of settler culture on stolen land. You can catch the newest episode of Yen Al Pasaran this afternoon on Thursdays from 4:30 to 5pm. And to hear the full interview with Ariel and Cam, head to 3cr.org.au/Yen Al Pasaran.
Could you tell us a little bit about Conspiracy Nation? What is the book and why did you write it?
Well, we started talking about this book at the beginning of 2023, I think. Both of us had been covering during the pandemic some of the false claims about the virus that were spreading, some of the groups that were coming together to protest the lockdowns, you know, what we've now called the anti-lockdown movement or the freedom movement, some of the key figures and gurus who were selling, you know, bizarre health plans or crowdfunding to raise like quixotic challenges at the High Court to vaccine mandates, all this activity. And it seemed like a good time to pause and look back at what had happened, but also to cast a wider view, because I think like in the media and in the, you know, public commentary, we think of conspiracy theories as something coming out of America, being imported into Australia, but we didn't really think that was quite right. And so this book was a chance for us to look more closely at Australia's own homegrown conspiracy theory culture, where it emerges from, what it kind of questions about our national character, our national stories, and look a bit more at the effects it's having on a personal and a community level.
Yeah, and Cam, like that video you saw, conspiracy theories really are everywhere. And one of the big things that people generally seem to say is that they think that conspiracy theories are a bigger part of their lives and bigger part of public life. Many people assume that more people believe in them. Actually, the evidence doesn't necessarily say that's true, but it's very hard to deny that they are not something that seems a lot more present in our lives. And like when you see a TikTok video of someone fearing that their school secretly has, is secretly turning their kids into furries, that is, of course, something that sounds ridiculous and is ridiculous. You know, that's not something that's really happening, but it is also quite revealing. These things that people fear, the things that they think are important and need to be protected, they all tell us something about, you know, what we are, what we value as Australians. And so our book was trying to look at, well, what do these actually tell us about? Let's look at them. Let's look at the conspiracy theories that are big in Australia, that have been started in Australia, and understand what they tell us about what it means to be Australian.
One of the events that you look at in the book is the Port Arthur massacre and the conspiracy theories that emerged from that. You look at it as being this foundational conspiracy myth in the Australian conspiracy landscape. Could you tell us a little bit about what the conspiracy theory is around Port Arthur, and if it's not obvious, and how it has resonated through the years?
Yeah, listeners of the show will probably be familiar, but so the Port Arthur massacre happened in 1996 when Martin Bryant opened fire at a cafe in Tasmania and killed a whole bunch of people. And the conspiracy theories that surround that are around this idea that either Bryant didn't do it and that he was set up for it, and they call that a false flag operation, or as well this other idea that maybe he did do it, but he was brainwashed or somehow tricked into doing it. And a lot of these are kind of linked back to this idea that as a result of the Port Arthur massacre, we saw this, you know, a rare thing in politics where we saw a drastic action on a topic, and Australia really cracked down and instituted much stricter gun laws. We wrote about it in the book because while, you know, conspiracy theories have always been around and long precede the internet, we were able to figure out that conspiracy theories around this event really took off once the internet started to become a big part of our lives. And that goes this idea that we're not sure that necessarily more people have conspiratorial thinking, are prone to thinking that there are secret plots or whatever everywhere, but the internet has allowed, in a way never before, for people to come together, to interact with each other and to organize. And that includes conspiracy theorists as well. And so in this way, we saw that the conspiracy theory around Port Arthur, you know, this idea that either it was set up or wasn't true, it suddenly went from maybe a few people muttering to, like you mentioned, Cam, a foundational belief where it's one of like almost like the original sins of the Australian government, according to like many conspiracy theorists who believe it's a big example of them taking action against the public, deceiving the public in order to disarm the public with ultimately some goal of a greater, more evil plan.
So they've taken our guns, but will they ever take our memes?
Never.
Did you find anything distinctive or distinctively Australian to the various ideas you examined in the book? Did they have an Australian flavour as opposed to, I guess, the US model?
It's a great question. And one I really got struck by was the Australian roots of pseudo-law. You know, people might be more familiar with the term sovereign citizen. But people, you know, because sovereign citizen is such a distinctly US term, prefer the pseudo-law genre, gives that overarching bucket in which to put a whole range of beliefs that end up at the same place around the illegitimacy of government or the inapplicability of laws to individuals. And yes, there is a strong history of that in the United States, but the history of that here precedes some of those really key moments, the Posse Comitatus in the American South in the 80s and 90s. We already had our own stuff up and running by that time. And often in Australia, it really centres around distinct historical moments. So whether it was the Federation of Australia or when we legally extricated ourselves from the UK legal system, where you could no longer appeal back to the UK, the end of the line, I guess, was the High Court within Australia. These are all key moments that sort of the history of pseudo law in Australia sort of points to as the moment when the Australian government became illegitimate, became a corporation, or some plot was enacted to put Australians under the thumb of some evil plot. So it was interesting to look at that and reclaim pseudo law for Australians in a perverse way and look at that history, because we also have this really distinct history of micronations where people have a plot of land, declare that it has seceded or was never part of the federal colony of Australia. And I think that really speaks to some of that settler mentality we have here, that unresolved history we have about our relationship to the original inhabitants of Australia, kind of uneasy place we have here as the people that came later post-colonisation. So it's all in this mix when it comes to pseudo law.
I do find myself in court on occasion, and it seems like it's not unusual to see pseudo law arguments getting run much more often these days. Has there been a big increase in pseudo law adherence in Australia?
It certainly feels like it. Like in the book, we look at this, the gauntlet that a lot of council workers, a lot of low-level courts have to run now with these pseudo law claims being thrown at them daily. Like the New South Wales Judiciary Handbook has had to be updated to include more information about how to deal with pseudo law litigants. There's certainly like a lot of gurus out there shilling courses held over Zoom, $200 a month to get out of parking fines and the like. And I spoke to one woman who's actually tried these arguments in an Australian courtroom. Suffice it to say, they haven't worked. But when you actually start talking to people that are trying to use these arguments, often it can be a pretty sad story. It's someone that has fallen through the cracks in some way, who has found themselves confronting like the impenetrable edifice of a bank or the legal system and has turned to these ideas in a desperation. So it's a really complex picture, but it certainly seems like it's ticking up and Australian courts are definitely struggling to deal with it.
Another claim that you examine in the book is popularly referred to as the Great Replacement, and there have been various, I guess, ideologues promoting it, but came to a rather bloody fruition in Christchurch in 2019. Can you guys tell us about what you found when you looked at those sorts of claims?
Yeah, this is probably one of the most confronting parts of reporting out the book, like taking a closer look at this idea of the Great Replacement. So basically the idea that there is some plot to undermine the white race or to eradicate it from certain Western nations. And the people behind the plot, it can be a whole cast of figures. Often it's Jewish people that are behind the so-called plot to eradicate the white race. And we find it appearing in different forms in Europe, in the United States. But when you look back like at the rhetoric in Australia of the past decade, we see those narratives flowing here through our media and our politics in all kinds of places. This idea that there is an invasion from the outside, whether it be the scapegoat of the day. In the 70s and 80s, perhaps it was Asian immigrants. Then it became Muslim immigrant with a distinct strain of Islamophobia. This really runs through Australian culture and our unease as a outpost of the West in Asia, I feel. Like, Andy, I talked to you for this chapter, actually, because you have all this history at your fingertips. I wonder how you see it playing out now, too.
That thesis now in 2025?
Mm.
Well, I think like a lot of the material you examine, the precise claims, they may be slightly augmented or adapted according to the circumstance, but that notion of a society in crisis that is at risk of implosion because of foreign elements of one sort or another seems to underpin a lot of politics and remain a constant factor. I think when it's picked up and given a very, let's say, radical or extremist interpretation, that's when I guess those are the situations or contexts in which these sorts of atrocities are more likely to appear. So I see it as a kind of, as you said, like a long-running tension that can be appealed to by various political actors at various stages when it suits them. So it remains a constant threat. The thing that I found, and it's documented elsewhere in the book, is the way in which those kinds of claims circulate through the body politic and become normalised. And so I'm not really sure what the current state of play is, but it it does appeal, it seems, to a whole range of more free-floating anxieties that are then crystallized in this form. So it remains, in a sense, a latent threat, as far as I can tell, and something that will be recurringly popular, especially to various sectors on the right.
Yeah, exactly. We really wanted to make that point in the book that we see conspiratorial narratives, frameworks being used by politicians in Australia, by the media. So that's something we wanted to confront in the book too. And in the Christchurch context, really that failure of Australia to take a good look at itself in the wake of the Christchurch massacre, to own the terrorist as an Australian person that grew up marinated in Australian culture, and really look at that more closely.
And the thing that really came out of the book as well was thinking about how in Australia, how often conspiracy theories are actually used and to reverse a power imbalance, but to make the vulnerable people into this great evil who can be hated. Like that's an example of the great replacement, changing it from, you know, the fact that in Australia, we're a multicultural nation, but like obviously people of color face a lot of racism. But by flipping this on its head, rather than being like, how are we treating people who are in some ways discriminated against, we turn this into this plot that in some ways that, you know, that this nation is being taken over by these people, and that allows, that gives a lot of people that permission structure to then feel like this is something that they should be fighting against, rather than perhaps interrogating maybe why they feel this way towards people who look different to them.
Just
what a great note to end on interrogating why you feel the way that you do. I think that can apply to a lot of the conversations that we're having today. And that was a segment from 3CR's Ye Na Pasaran, which you can hear later today from 4:30 to 5 p.m, a show that's examining ethno-nationalism, white supremacy and neo-fascism in so-called Australia, hosted by Andy Fleming and Cam Smith. And in that conversation, you just heard authors Ariel Bogle and Cam Wilson speak about their new book, Conspiracy Nation, and discuss some notable conspiracy theories emerging from the colonial legacies of settler culture on stolen land. And Leela, what do we have on now?
Now I am excited to introduce Jay Coonan from the Anti-Poverty Centre, who's going to speak to us about the Commonwealth Ombudsman report into the maladministration of Centrelink's targeted compliance framework, also known as, to people on Centrelink payments, mutual obligations. The first report from the Ombudsman investigation found that failures within the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations, or DEWR, are responsible for the unlawful reduction and cancellation of Centrelink payments for thousands of people receiving income support. Jay Coonan works with the Anti-Poverty Centre to advocate for systemic change and end conditional welfare programs such as Centrelink's mutual obligations. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Now, first of all, this report is very recent. What prompted the investigation, and has anything changed to prompt it?
No to the second part, but we'll get more into that. But basically, at the end of last year, the Department of Employment, or DEWR for short, came to ourselves, ACOS and Economic Justice Australia, and admitted that they had unlawfully cancelled people's payments due to faults with the targeted compliance framework. So mm-hmm. We knew about this late last year, and they have kind of been kicking the can down the road. And it was by March that the Secretary at Senate Estimates admitted that this had happened, but they were trying to like keep under wraps the scale of what was happening.
Right.
So basically they had to stop payment cancellations. So that meant that if you received five or more demerits and, entered the payment cancellation period, your payment would have been cancelled. And there were other aspects. So if you didn't re-engage with your provider after 28 days, your payment would have been cancelled, but they've just mm-hmm. stopped those because the secretary doesn't have confidence that the system is operating lawfully. So, but what remains in place is payment suspension. So mm-hmm. if you don't apply for your jobs, you don't rock up to a meeting, your payment will still be put on hold. So that's still in play at the moment. So,
okay.
Yeah, that's kind of how it came to be.
Yeah, thank you for that background. I have so many thoughts being a Centrelink recipient myself, but something I really wanted to get into is you're mentioning suspensions and cancellations. So they're basically considered payment penalties. Who has the power to enforce a payment penalty? And what would it look like being at the receiving end of a payment penalty for a welfare recipient? Like how do those come through the system to people on income support?
Yeah, so that's actually a great question because obviously the Ombudsman report is about the targeted compliance framework that you mentioned. And some of the discussion yesterday about the targeted compliance framework, or TCF, mm-hmm. is that it's automated. But what they're really kind of missing out in this bigger picture is that it's not automated. It's not fully automated. It's operated by the employment service providers, which have a very long history of bullying and harassment. And the targeted compliance framework is used by providers to bully and harass people. Mm-hmm. So if your provider, for example, and this is very well documented, believes that you, without any evidence, has a job and they think that you're lying to them or lying to Centrelink, they will book meetings in a very short time frame. They won't register when you've attended to appointments. And what that happens is you'll get a text message on your phone saying your payment's been put on hold and that you need to re-engage, otherwise it could be cancelled. So that, we know, places an immense amount of pressure and stress on people who are living below mm-hmm. the poverty line. And, you know, we'll have to change their schedule the next day because generally these come through at 5 p.m. when you can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
So you have to change your studies, try and get off work, change your doctor's appointment to try and fix this where some, outsourced bully is using semi-automated class warfare against you.
Yeah. And often you have to go through the Centrelink phone service. You can't actually amend it via your job agency, as they're called. But that you touched on a really interesting point about job agencies enforcing these penalties. And it brought up the question of who gets to decide whether a penalty is lawful or not.
That is a great question. I mean, the law says that providers have the power to decide when it is lawful, but obviously there are policies and regulations and laws that these untrained providers have the power to enforce, but aren't lawfully doing it. And we know they're not doing it. And the secretary believes that it is still happening lawfully. And if they did a very rudimentary investigation into whether or not providers are exercising their discretion of power correctly, the whole system would topple down. I mean, you know, there is an auditing process that the department has over providers, but, you know, from speaking to whistleblowers and hearing about stories, that may be coming up, we know the department's not doing that properly. So, you know, once that kind of is exposed, the whole system could essentially just crumble. But there is no genuine concern or curiosity from the department or government about this situation. Mm. So it's really just on them at this point now.
Yeah, absolutely. And things, mutual obligations are not met for so many reasons. Like one example could be that in my personal experience, I had a job provider with a very high turnover rate of staff. So I wasn't able to get an appointment for over a month, which technically would have cancelled my payment because there wasn't anyone working at the actual agency to kind of approve things. But I was still considered, I think I lost a demerit for that. So there's this presumption that people are doing the wrong thing. They're being willfully non-compliant or out to cheat the system and not really in need. Can you speak a bit about basically a system that presumes guilt, and really I think what it is criminalizing people in poverty, because some of these things can result in paying back debts and things that are really legally harmful.
Yeah, I mean, you're completely correct in saying that it criminalizes people in poverty by presuming that they are doing, you know, that they're presumptively doing the wrong thing. The way that the rules work is to, you know, assume guilt before knowing any of the evidence. So, you know, it's called a reasonable excuse or valid reason. And there's these very legalistic and complex ways in which you must prove that you, in fact, were not doing the wrong thing, rather than actually looking into why, you know, you didn't do what you did.
Right. Jay, can I ask, are people receiving Centrelink privy to the information that of how they can prove that their non-compliance was valid? Or is that something that the system knows and people using the system don't know?
Might just get you to reword that because I'm not entirely sure.
So you were talking about a reasonable excuse for not meeting your mutual obligations.
Mm-hmm.
Do people on Centrelink have access to what those reasonable excuses are, or do you kind of just have to attempt to justify yourself, and then Centrelink is the one basically holding the book of reasonable excuses?
Yeah. So you have to justify yourself to your provider, and your provider, in their discretionary powers and using this very legalistic framework that they have no idea about, will decide whether or not your decision was reasonable or not. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're not provided with, you know, any of these resources, and people have had to go to, you know, groups like the Australian Unemployed Workers Union, or we help with, like, certain individual cases. But largely it is just way too complex. So even if you do have a reasonable excuse, as the law says, you know, it still may not be enough because you don't know how to advocate for yourself. You don't know who to go to get it removed. Or you just might just be like, oh, whatever, I don't care. Like, this is just way too hard and I just need to get on with my day. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there will be, you know, thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of demerits currently in the system where they're not actually applied lawfully or correctly. But, you know, they have the ability to impact somebody.
Yeah, and a bit more about that impact. What have you found at Anti-Poverty Centre, what impact a suspension, reduction or cancellation of a Centrelink payment has on people who rely on welfare to survive?
I think the biggest thing is, like, going back to just receiving a text, like that automated text message set up by somebody somewhere else, just places an immense amount of stress and pressure on somebody. Like someone that we work with, Roxanne, she was talking yesterday on ABC Radio about that. And it's, you know, it's about the stress that comes from it. It's about having to reorganize your schedule the next day when you've got a young child or a disabled kid, or you yourself have disabilities and appointments. It's about the stress and the additional administrative burden that it, you know, places on you. But then there's the more, you know, kind of like extreme end of the scale where in The Guardian last month it was reported that somebody who was involuntarily, you know, admitted for mental health reasons had their payment cancelled, which meant that their rent didn't get paid, the afterpay, which, you know, people in poverty use to pay for their medication because they don't make enough, was incurring fees and placing them further in debt. And so with the help of a social worker from the hospital, they went to their provider to try and have this resolved and get the demerits removed and their payments set back up so they could get back pay. And they were bullied and harassed by their provider if despite all the evidence and a social worker, they didn't believe them. Yeah. And so it took them so long to be able to get this instituted, and were hundreds of reinstituted the payments, and there were hundreds of dollars in debt by the end of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think also that's something that people who haven't been in the system maybe don't fully understand, is that even if you can work with the system, you're still subject to an amount of emotional, I don't want to say abuse, but I think it can feel abusive, especially to people yeah. who've experienced trauma. The emotional toll is huge. Even if you do end up getting that payment, it might take people months, weeks, or it might trigger a mental health episode for people to deal with that stress and that treatment that's just so degrading to your sense of humanity.
Yeah, no, that's completely correct. It is. And it's spiritually and psychologically so violent, the way that you're treated. And, you know, the people who are operating these, the people who are weaponizing the broken targeted compliance framework, they're not social workers. They're basically entry-level people who, you know, wanted to get out of hospitality, who wanted to get out of, you know, other jobs, who were probably doing other admin jobs and just needed to pick up another job. There's no training, and their job is just to tick and flick using a broken, violent, semi-automated system.
Yeah, that's right. There's a huge amount of disruptions to people's lives from this. And, it's also been mentioned that if you're hospitalised, you can have your payments cut off. But just to wrap up, Jay, as a result of this investigation, what does the Anti-Poverty Centre want to see change? And do you think we could see the end of something like mutual obligations?
We want to see the immediate abolition of the mutual obligations. So that means no more compulsory appointments, no more, payment suspensions or payment penalties in any shape, form, or size, and to build a new supportive system that actually helps people and meets them where they're at. Where do we think we'll get there at this stage? Probably not. Look, the Ombudsman, despite yesterday's report, is currently in the process of writing a second report due to the size and complexity of employment services. Mm. However, we know that the government it really doesn't care. The new minister, Amanda Rishworth, is obviously from the right of the Labor Party and SDA, so that might give some understanding towards personal politics. So what we've heard is that they have no interest in changing mutual obligation. So as long as that's their position, we're not going to see any change. But through this pressure, through these reports from, you know, independent groups like the Ombudsman and others that may be coming up, you know, it may help to begin to build that pressure, build that media interest in order to finally get this system over and done with.
Mm-hmm. And just your final thoughts, what can people do to support the process of ending mutual obligations, and what can people on welfare do to protect themselves a little bit?
Yeah, so I would recommend, finding more about your rights if you are on mutual obligations through the Australian Unemployed Workers Union. Mm-hmm. The Anti-Poverty Centre, while we're not a mass movement organisation, we do provide, individual support for people who are having some issues. So we'll be able to provide resources, and we also have a chat where people on mutual obligations can kind of come and provide like mutual support and provide advice as well. So you'll find out by just sending a message through Facebook or Instagram, or even jumping onto our Twitter getting some more information. We can hook you up and help you out.
Yeah, thanks. We'll make sure to include the links to those resources in our podcast notes. Jay, thank you so much for speaking to us today.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
Bye. You just heard Jay Coonan from the Anti-Poverty Centre, who spoke to us about the Commonwealth Ombudsman investigation into maladministration of Centrelink's targeted compliance framework, also known as mutual obligations. And the first report was just released, and it found that failures within the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations, or DEWA, are responsible for the unlawful reduction and cancellation of thousands of Centrelink payments impacting thousands of people. This is Thursday Breakfast, and you're listening to 3CR 855 AM.
Do you have a fine you're worried about? If you are struggling to pay a fine, there can be ways to help you deal with it. You may be able to get your fine lifted or reduced where you are experiencing difficult life circumstances, such as family violence, mental health challenges, disability, homelessness, or drug or alcohol dependency. If you have fines from not paying toll roads, you may also be able to get the fine waived if you're experiencing financial or other hardship. Speak to a community lawyer or financial counsellor to get advice on your options. You can find your local community centre on the Federation of Community Legal Centres website, fclc.org.au. You can find a financial counsellor by calling the National Debt Helpline on 1800 007 007. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
And welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. It's currently the 7th of August at 7:46. If you are just joining us, we've played some of our headlines. We've played a segment from Yena Pasaran's talk with Arielle Bogle and Cam Wilson on the Conspiracy Nation. And Lily just spoke to Jay from the Anti-Poverty Centre about mutual obligations. And I wanted to take some time to highlight to a campaign that we have received messaging about and are seeing kind of like all over the place is toll and driving genocide. And I wanted to draw attention to, I'll bring everybody's attention to it as well, because I know that everybody's been seeing it on their social media, but I was there at the rally, and it was really interesting to see how Toll is a logistics provider, not just for for weapons and genocide in Palestine, but also ammunition here, and as well as supplying, you know, tent cities for offshore detention in Nauru and in Manus Island as well. And I'm wondering if you wanted to, before I go into some of the topics, like how insidious like logistics and transport can be.
Yeah, I mean, I think logistics and supply chains are something that we don't tend to pay enough attention to when it comes to facilitating the military industrial complex and in particular genocide. And so actually attending not just to the people that are manufacturing weapons, but also to the companies that are complicit in transporting them, to actually getting them, the bullet to the gun, as it were, making sure that genocidaires and repressive militaries can actually carry out their plans is so contingent on logistics companies. And as we've seen from the Stop Driving Genocide campaign, people have really been drawing attention to the fact that Toll is quite deeply embedded in repressive activities, not just overseas, but also across the country in so-called Australia.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know we've spoken about many manufacturers. You know, we have Farah, we have Thales, and actually Toll and Thales are seen as a very key, important business partner. So much information on Toll. it is on, let me just double check. It is tolldeath.noblogs.org. And it's very, very comprehensive, and it's really drawing off similar, you know, Palestine action campaigns and front-runner logistics. And I know that it can seem quite broad, but what's been really amazing to see this kind of resurgence alongside, you know, protest and rallying is the ongoing direct action. You know, we saw it with the student encampments, and just knowing that there are so many ways to participate and support to interrupt this supply chain, knowing that it is, Australia is a Western imperial nation, similar to the US, that often gets left behind. I think about Penny Wong's comments of recently of, oh, we don't, you know, the parts are not deadly.
Mm. Yeah, which is, you know, wholly ingenuous and, disingenuous. is ingenuous a word? Wholly disingenuous, but also, you know, Australia, I think, gets much less scrutiny than it should when we're looking at international weapon supply chains and, you know, military intelligence. I think about the Five Eyes program and the centrality of Pine Gap on Aranda country near Mpantwa Alice Springs for being a signals intelligence hub. And so, you know, Australia, through its partnership in the AUKUS deal, also is, you know, deeply embedded in these relationships and facilitating, you know, so many egregious military violences around the world. And, you know, in so many cases has also had boots on the ground. Like I don't think people have forgotten about Afghanistan and, you know, Ben Robert Smith and the fact that we have, you know, whistleblowers like David McBride now, you know, having faced sanctions for drawing attention to Australia's direct complicity in these violations around the world. So it's really important that Australia doesn't escape scrutiny here just because it's like far away in the Antipodes or whatever.
Oh, absolutely. I think even with, you know, from reading about this and what's been stated in the press releases is the, you know, the Bilala and the Mawar factories, which are toll operated, produce artillery shells. And I think the arms production is similar to, yeah, like militarized sites and is complicit here. And there's so much, lack that I think Australia as a colony gets, but also the logistics company. And even thinking about, you know, Nauru and Manus Island, sometimes it can feel like maybe these are not 100% current at the moment, or, you know, some things have ended and some contracts have ended. There's like a current contract that Perry Singh talks about in quite, fever. Like, oh, we're very proud to like be the reliable, like government contracted.
I mean, I think a big part of it that is also overlooked about these things called logistics and transport, which we, you know, the everyday person that doesn't work in that space, we don't always see how things operate. You know, you don't really see how the workplace operates or how far trucks are traveling or ships are traveling. Because it is quite separate from our daily lives, but it underpins colonial culture. So transport is how colonialism has enforced power since colonization began and European expansion began. And I've been reading the Toll website, and they actually talk about how they have some things they want to preserve and some things they want to change at Toll in terms of their company values. And I just thought that was really went to the heart of the fact that protecting their interests, protecting their values, violence, exploitation, control and marginalization that the transport industry, the colonial transport industry, has enforced onto colonized people, that is a core part of their values that they're looking to preserve. So their choices are informed by preserving those unequal power dynamics and abusive power dynamics.
I think so important with like a note on language, with how Toll speaks about even offshore detention and how they are like a trusted like medical escort, they say, or like a supportive, like it's just a van. We're just supporting people, taking them to their medical appointments.
Yeah, see, it's framed very much as neutral.
Yeah,
Yeah. And like, I think this is where like even the word logistics itself seems very big and very abstract. But what we're talking about is companies that are signing up to facilitate these processes of violence. And so if you think about it from a worker perspective, maybe somebody who's driving one of those trucks doesn't really know the gravity of what they're transporting. But that just goes to show how normalized, you know, logistics companies' participation in facilitating these kinds of violences is. Because if you think about logistics as a choke point, it seems too big to attend to, but that's only because it has such a stranglehold on the way that we access, you know, the various materials and goods that we need for our everyday lives. And then you realize that if the military industrial complex, the detention complex and coloniality is embedded into these systems, that we get everything that we need to sustain our lives through, but also these death-making, you know, companies also need, you realize that it's structural change that's required.
Yeah. I think the work issue or the how organizations kind of operate is such an important piece here, because it holds such a monopoly as well. And I know that the current demands from the campaign are that Toll drop the partnerships with Thales, NIOA and other arms dealers, cease providing services to the Australian military, the mining sector and detention projects. And it's currently that Japan Post Direct Toll, its wholly owned subsidiary, to drop all partnerships and cease providing services in line with international law. And there have been one, two, three current direct actions that you can see on the Black People's Union, as well as for Autonomy Destroy Australia. And that was on the, I believe, on the 21st, the 22nd and the 18th of July. But thanks so much for bringing this important discussion to light.
Yes, thank you.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
Have you heard of long COVID? If you or someone you know have had COVID-19, you may still experience symptoms weeks or months later. There are many symptoms of long COVID, but the most frequent are extreme tiredness, shortness of breath, and muscle aches and joint pains. Anyone can experience long COVID, including children. You can find information in your language on the Health Translations website, healthtranslations.vic.gov.au. Just type long COVID as a keyword.
A 3CR supporter.
Panoply, panorama, panpipe, pansy, aha, pansexual, knowing no boundaries of sex or gender. Sound interesting? Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan. All those gender questions making you think too hard? Whether it's transgender, bisexual, polyamorous or beyond, we'll throw those questions into the pan and cook up the answers for you. So go on, push that gender envelope. Only on 3CR 855 AM digital and 3cr.org.au. Let's cook, 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 cook. Let's cook.
Let's eat. Let's eat. You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 8 o'clock in the morning, And the weather today, look, it feels like 3.7 degrees, the Bureau of Meteorology tells us. It's 6.9 degrees with a maximum of 14. No rain predicted, but it looks like it's going to be cloudy with some light winds. Now, we are going to be joined by Inner West local Monty Green, a disability pensioner, community organizer, musician, and former hospitality worker, to discuss the grassroots Footscray community response campaign, which is fighting against a recent council decision to use bylaws to harass and displace homeless people in the city of Maribyrnong. On July 23rd, council members voted in favour of employing private security in response to local social and health concerns, despite widespread concern from local residents, workers, health and legal professionals about the detrimental impacts that this punitive approach will have on rough sleepers and other vulnerable community members. Now, we'll also be asking Monty about a public meeting, the Footscray Community Forum, which is coming up next Thursday, the 14th of August. But for now, good morning, Monty.
Morning, Priya. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. It's a bit early for me to be up, a bit of a flashback to my cafe days.
Well, thank you.
I'm glad to be here with you.
Yes, thank you very much for making the time and for joining us at this hour. Now, I wanted to ask you, first of all, about your interest in this issue, the Maribyrnong Council's decision, this broader anti-homeless crackdown that we're seeing across LGAs in the Melbourne area, and why you believe in safer and supportive responses for your local community.
Well, first of all, I think that everybody should care, right? That the risk of homelessness and of disenfranchisement is real to everybody in our community, and that we all have a stake in safer and more supportive responses, because any one of us could experience crisis and find ourselves in need of those supports. But for me personally, my interest in this kind of starts with my own experience of mental health and of housing insecurity. So I had a 12-year career in hospital prior to being a disability pensioner. And it was pretty unstable. There were times in that period where I couldn't work enough to support myself and where I couldn't make rent. And I was really fortunate to have friends that could let me couch surf with them for free, like in one case for over a year. And you know, I know all too well that you can't choose your symptoms of mental health. I'm having some heart palpitations right now that I certainly did not pick. But I also know that you're lucky if your symptoms and your position in life lets you as a mentally ill person still be perceived as safe and still let you access welfare and therapy. And you know, like I have a legal cannabis prescription that lets me get the treatment that I need without criminalization. Mm. And lots of people with mental health conditions don't have that good fortune. And really for me, the thing that underpins like the failures of a force-based model for mental health is that approach cost me a relationship with my mum. She's a diagnosed schizophrenic. During the lockdown years, she had a breakdown, and in the years since has experienced a mental health decline and been arrested a couple of times. And I think that she would disagree with that assessment, which I think is also kind of the point. During her psychotic break in like 2021, I called the CAT team, and you know, because I was feeling unsafe in of being around her in a state that I perceived to be delusional. And calling the CAT team tried to essentially force treatment. And while that helped me to feel safer, to have resources to look after her while she was unwell, she couldn't feel safe when she felt like she was being forced into treatment. And that has kind of compounded years of medical trauma and led into a kind of like a real radicalization and forced her away from care. So I know really, really intimately that force-based approaches don't work and that care does.
Yeah, look, thank you so much for taking us through that, and I appreciate that it's not an easy thing to talk about, but it really does show, you know, how violent and how intimately violent force-based approaches to people's experiences of mental health crisis, of extreme vulnerability when it comes to housing insecurity, are not really treating the cause of the problem, structural inequality, structural ableism and various other violences, but actually turning people into problems at sometimes the worst points in their lives. And I did want to ask you to quickly recap what the Maribyrnong Council voted to introduce on the 23rd of July and who's actually been lobbying for these changes.
So there's a year and a half of really complicated local context. But it was actually the 22nd of July, I believe, that the council session where they voted on a security proposal. And to give you a sense of time, that proposal was tabled 3 days before by the Mayor Pradeep Tiwari. And that came about a week and a half after he and other councillors met with a group of central CBD traders at a local bar in Footscray. And at that meeting, he heard testimony from staff and business owners in the central CBD area who have been harassed and assaulted at work because of these kind of competing claims of use for public space between local traders and rough sleepers. And so the proposal that he took to council, you know, a week later with 3 days' notice to vote on was based on the City of Melbourne trial, which was of less than 6 months' duration, and it focused on a model where you pair local laws officers, so in infringements officers essentially, with security guards to help those law officers feel safe on the job. And the council says that this will be a passive non-enforcement role for the security guards and that it's about making their staff and their contractors feel, and the traders, feel safe by just having security present in Footscray and supporting laws officers when they do their job. And I really do agree that traders and council staff and contractors deserve that safety. But when we're talking about local laws officers, I think the thing that we're forgetting is that that job is ultimately in making Footscray unsafe and unwelcoming for poor and homeless people in the name of commerce. Mm. So we've heard reports of like confiscating possessions. Like I've got some unconfirmed reports of council staff hosing down public spaces to make it inhospitable to homeless people trying to sleep. And this new model really just adds a security presence as a performance of safety for the traders and for the patrons of the Footscray area, and to make those law officers feel safe while they're doing their jobs. And it's really, I think, ill-considered and not realistic to what it's going to be like to have the implicit threat of security standing over you while you're being issued a fine.
Yeah, and I mean, you say passive enforcement, and really what that sounds like is active intimidation of people who are forced to live outside because we are in the midst of a housing crisis and, you know, the withdrawal or, you know, service provision model of so many community services means that sometimes people who are struggling with the most complex set of circumstances with intersecting needs are the ones that are not just falling through the cracks, but are pushed through the cracks and then subjected to these punitive responses. It also is striking that Pradeep Tiwari was involved in this, just given, I recall being at the Justice for Abdi Fattah rally after Abdi Fattah Ahmed was shot by Victoria Police and killed in Footscray earlier this year. And I can recall him speaking at that rally and, you know, hearing councillors' statements of remorse about the tragic loss of life of rough sleepers in the community, but also seeing these kinds of actions shows a real mismatch between, you know, the kind of supportive harm reduction services that are required and the harmful and, you know, effectively deputizing private security that has been proposed and now introduced. So can you talk as well about some of the local organizing efforts against these bylaws that are being used to target homeless people, as well as maybe some of the complementary initiatives that are exploring alternative community-based safety responses?
Yeah, so honestly, I don't think I personally have a full picture of everything that's happening yet. There's this like really beautiful tapestry of community approaches from a million different perspectives that if you care to look is already happening, not just in Footscray, but in every community that faces challenges. So I know that Bayel Kabbalan is an African cultural centre that recently had a GoFundMe up to help continue their efforts in Footscray. I know that Vixens has been supporting Asian migrant sex workers who have been unjustly targeted by the border force in Footscray. But for me, my entry point into this and my organising was as a hospo worker. So I was hearing stories of my friends being unsafe at work and lacking resources to manage their safety in the Footscray CBD, and that when they called the police, they were either non-responsive or showing up aggressive and inflaming things. And at the same time as that, I was seeing increasing hostility towards homeless and drug-using people in Footscray in local discourse, and that I wanted to try and join local hospital workers together just in solidarity with their colleagues who are facing violence at work, but balancing that against the need for more compassionate and safe and supportive responses for the people that they were coming into conflict with. And so we're called Footscray Hospo, and we're planning a series of social and upskilling events for local hospital workers. We're trying to put together a fundraising event with local hospital workers who are in bands, and basically just trying to find ways to group together as a local industry group and to use our skills and our relationships and our talents to serve both local hospital workers and our community. And my work with that led us to Borderlands Cooperative and to Footscray Community Response, which is a new group. We're still getting established and building relationships and trust and getting a sense of where we can fit into the broader community. But the goal is to be a coalition of community groups and stakeholders that can provide a meeting space to really have serious and thoughtful conversations about the problems facing Footscray and to imagine new approaches and to build them together.
Yeah. I mean, it is... heartening to see the massive upsurge in grassroots community organizing. I mean, it's been around for a long time, but especially seeing people come together under the Footscray Community Response banner to try and workshop what safety looks like to them without these punitive responses, and what safety looks like for the whole community, acknowledging that people sleeping rough in the community, people experiencing mental health challenges, people who use drugs are part of the community. So I think it is really, really beautiful to see that coming together. And I wanted to ask you about what is planned for next week, because I believe on Thursday the 14th, Footscray Community Response is going to be putting on a public meeting.
That's correct. So Thursday the 14th from 6 to 8 p.m. it's going to be at the St. John's Hall at 30A Pickett Street. And it's our first broad community event as Footscray Community Response. And it's trying to get in before the next council session to spark local conversation and start building some of those connections and bringing out the ideas that already exist in our community. And to do some of the hard work of consultation that council did not do before voting on this proposal. We're still confirming speakers, but we're trying to recruit speakers who can give alternative perspectives on a local narrative that's been dominated by fear and panic and stigma and racism. And the kind of biggest takeaway for me in the process of organizing it all and doing this work is the need to be responsive to our own failure and our limitations. Like, I don't know 100% that this is going to be the event or that this is going to be the group that saves Footscray, but it's a place to start, and I think that Footscray really needs a place to start and to see what we can build together for positive community-led responses.
Yeah, I think it is a really good start. And I was also wondering, just to wrap up, how people who are sleeping rough are going to be involved in this process?
So, like I said, we are reaching out through our networks to find speakers who are comfortable presenting to a group to give their own lived experience and, you know, trying to build relationships where we can. But it is very early days. But I think it's really essential to center those voices, because in the local conversation, in the societal conversation, people just really aren't asking homeless people how these policies affect them in their daily lives. And we do know, you know, from our outreach to local rough sleepers and from our contact with health workers who were in the city of Melbourne during their trial, that this is a policy that will make homeless people feel unsafe and unwelcome and intimidated, and that the lack of privacy and autonomy that rough sleepers already experience, like the dependency on services to meet their basic need, will only be made more acute through increased scrutiny and stigma, and that it doesn't offer solutions that will make Footscray safer. If anything, it stands a real risk of inflaming things and making people less safe.
Mm. Thank you so much, Monty. We will have information in our show notes about how people can get involved, but I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
That was Inner West local Monty Green, who's a disability pensioner, community organizer, musician, and former hospitality worker, who was speaking with us about the grassroots Footscray community response campaign, fighting against a recent council decision to use bylaws to harass and displace homeless people in the city of Maribyrnong. And you can find out more information, including about that public meeting, by heading to footscraycommunityresponse.net. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 8:16 in the morning.
Questions, questions, questions flooding into the mind of the concerned young person today.
It's nearly Science Week again, so you better be getting your teams ready for the annual Lost in Science Trivia for 2025.
Yes, Monday the 11th of August, starting at 6 at the Birmingham Hotel in Fitzroy, Melbourne.
All the details on the 3CR website or on the Lost in Science Facebook page.
And if you want to register for a table, email us at lostinsci@gmail.com.
Hi everyone, my name's Robbie Thorpe. I'm with 3CR Community Radio. Every year we have a subscription drive. It's a way of supporting our organisation maintain itself through the year, and we rely on the support of the community. One way to do that is to subscribe and become a member. Become part of this organisation itself. Get in contact with 3CR. You can go to the website 3cr.org.au or you can ring on 9419 8377. 3CR ensures that our voices, Aboriginal voices, are heard on this radio station. So it's a good way of supporting Aboriginal people as well by becoming a subscriber for 3CR Community Radio.
And welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast on Thursday the 7th of August. And now we have Nicole Tadpole McIver, who is a captain and inaugural player for the Mount Alexander Falcons, woo woo woo, and has been in the team's leadership group since its inception in 2022. They're passionate about footy and even more passionate about community. And here to talk about on Sunday, the July 27th, where the Falcons football team held a transgenderist celebration in Harcourt Regional Queensland, initially organised as a response to the Riddles District Football Netball League, excluding trans players, but making it a beautiful day. Thank you so much for joining me here today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I was wondering if you'd tell us a little bit more about, you know, the Falcons and really, like, get a sense for what the team is like.
Yeah, for sure. So I guess I've loved footy all my life, but never got the chance to play in a team because I wasn't a boy. So I grew up in country Victoria, and it was never an option for me. And also I've been doing a show on Triple R for like over 20 years. So I've played in the Community Cup a lot of times. You've probably been to the Community Cup.
Yes, I have.
Listeners would have been there as well. So I kind of grew up doing that, thinking that, you know, that's what footy was. And then, and growing up around, you know, country footy clubs. But then I moved to Castlemaine, and a year or so later, my friend told me that there was this women and gender diverse footy club starting up. I thought, oh my God, this could be my chance. Not really knowing what to expect, but I rocked up to a come and try, and I just was blown away. It was so welcoming, inclusive. There was no pressure to, like, prove yourself or be tough or, you know, be a tough head. And, I loved it. I was hooked straight away and just kept coming back. And I don't know if you've seen the documentary Equal the Contest, made by Mitch Navalis, who was a player at the Falcons. But that kind of documents our a bit of the story of how the club started and the knockback that we had from the league that we applied to play in and all of the discrimination that we faced along the way. But we are still a club today against all the odds, and it's just such a huge part of my life and of the other people who are involved in the team. And it's like a family. It's a real community, as yeah. well as just being a really fun footy team to play in. So, yeah, it's huge. It's not, it's like footy I've never experienced like this before.
Yeah, definitely. That's so special to think about. I can relate similar to like growing up playing like soccer and football and feeling, yeah, like there's such a performance to it. But the best parts about sport really is the community and the showing up every day and kind of letting it out on the field. And I'm wondering how you have seen sport act as kind of as a vehicle for social change, either like in the team or in the community. Because I know that the Falcons really value inclusivity and solidarity, but I'm sure you get a lot of pushback, you know, being in regional Victoria and being the team that you are.
Absolutely, for sure. It's sometimes it's exhausting because you feel like every time you take the field or every time you do something with the Falcons that you're fighting some, you know, crap behaviour or bad attitudes or, you know, antiquated kind of attitudes. So it can be exhausting, but it's just huge. Like, it's a platform. And one of my teammates actually a couple of weeks ago said, I never realised sport could be a vehicle for social change. And I said, yeah, until I joined this team, I didn't realise it either. but because we do gather heaps of people, we have a big crowd come to our games who just love what the Falcons are about. And we try and, you know, just give a safe space, a welcoming space to people who would never normally like sport, especially AFL. and, you know, people come and they're like, I've never watched a footy game before. And we're like, great, because the vibe is brilliant and, you know, we're all smiling on the field. And then because we do have that crowd, you know, come to see us, we are visible in the community, lots of Falcons beanies in the town. Then we are able to, you know, make banners and put out statements and let people know what we stand for and what our values are. So, yeah, we had the trans and gender diverse pride match in response to the Riddle League banning some trans netball players. So we were able to make it a really positive thing, you know, like a celebration rather than, you know, strictly a protest. So I think that's where it comes from, like bringing joy, celebrating diversity, you know, celebrating people who are often ignored and excluded and turning it into a joyful thing. And then that ripples out and the teams we play pick up on that as well. So, yeah, I think it's kind of leading by example, but just, yeah, turning it into joy and celebrating what we have. Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah, it sounds really cool and definitely not an easy feat. And you can just tell by the way that you're speaking and how you're speaking about the team that there's been such a commitment and care to not just like on the field, but off it as well to really, yeah, support and really integrate the community within the sport. I'm curious about, you know, from where it has started, you know, you've been an inaugural member and in a leadership position, and now it's like three years on. How has the team kind of changed its, I guess, standing within the community, or how it has supported the team itself?
Well, I think we just keep getting bigger and stronger. And people, we just kind of reach more people and you know, keep putting our values out there. You know, shout out to our sibling club, the Darabin Falcons. They're a standalone club. We're a standalone club. I think we've probably just really stayed true to our values and not back down, but we're also like quite honest in how hard it is and whatever, but we kind of get around each other and check in with each other on and off the field. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes that the players aren't necessarily like cognitive of, you know, every day. But yeah, I guess there's lots of layers to it. There's lots of people involved I guess the community just picks up on that and gets around us. And I think, it's hard because each year we probably go to the league and say, all right, this was what our season was like. what about if we change this, this and this? You know, and it doesn't always come back in a positive way, but we're just by taking the field, we are being visible, and, you know, that's a huge thing in itself, just by this group of people who would never probably join a club that is attached to a men's, a team that's attached to a men's club. This is a place for us, and just by being visible, you know, other people in the community feel seen and heard as well, and I think that's really huge.
Yeah, amazing. I want to, you know, quickly touch on something that you said of, like, how important sport is, particularly, you know, for people who are transgender diverse in a regional town, and yeah, being really visible, but how special sport can be to kind of, yeah, just be a center point and anchor in your life. But yeah, I'm wondering with the team, how do you think it really influences people's days and ability to kind of connect with that sporting culture that might have felt really far away?
Yeah, it's huge. Because I was excluded from footy all my life, I played netball, but that's a very small team and it wasn't, you know, like a family. When we first started with the Falcons and it became this massive family, and, you know, I wouldn't know a lot of these people if it wasn't for the Falcons, because I wouldn't have been able to connect up with them in another way. When it first we started, I was like, oh my God, I've been excluded from this kind of bonding and family all my life. Mm-hmm. Like, this is so unfair, you know. It's a huge family. I guess maybe because it's a physical sport too, everyone, well, in the Falcons anyway, we're like ultra, like, checking in and making sure everyone feels safe. We really concentrate on safe tackling and stuff like that. So if we start with the basis of making sure that everyone is feeling okay and safe and included and safe to be themselves, then it kind of grows from there. And yeah, we have so many different offshoots of the Falcons. Like, we've got little community groups, and, you know, I had to fix up a house that I owned last year and move all the stuff out and get it ready to sell. Half the team came. It was like a roster system, and we you know, flipped that house in you know, a couple of months. I couldn't have done that without the Falcons. So just from, feeling like you're with your people, it's huge. It's massive. And it's so good for our well-being. And being able to play sport alongside those people is just, like, it's amazing. It's the best. It's so good for all of our well-being. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I don't want to hone it onto the, no doubt, the amount of, like, misogyny and transphobia that you would have to push up against in a regional Victorian town. But I really want to focus on, like, how can we learn more about the Falcons, watch and attend games, how can people follow along, and just really, like, any advice to anyone wanting to watch?
Yeah, I guess, well, in terms of pushing back against misogyny and the transphobia and all that, I try not to read any comments.
Yep.
And I'm really just not on the social media. So, you know, other people in the team are a bit better at that than I am. But, yeah, we just try and, as I said, like, spin it into a positive thing. I guess you can keep up with the Falcons on Instagram and Facebook, but we've also got a website, which is mountalexanderfalcons.com.au, which is MT Alexander Falcons. Our season's over. We got eliminated. We've made our first final last week.
Oh, amazing. Congrats.
Yeah, but we lost. But so stoked to actually make the final. We were just all smiling and joyful afterwards. I guess just follow along. If you're interested in coming to train, pre-season will probably start November, December. And it's always fun to come and watch games at Harcourt because, it's such a vibe. So if people are in Melbourne, make the trip up. Get the train. Someone will pick you up. And, and it's just a good day. So probably social media mostly is the way to stay in touch. And, come and see it.
Amazing. Thank you so much for coming on the show. That's all we sadly have time for. But we have all the links in our show notes. And I hope you have a very restful time in your new house as well.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Trevor. Bye.
Bye.
And that was Nicole Talpa-McIver, who is the captain and inaugural player for Mount Alexander Falcons, talking about trans and gender diverse celebration games and in regional Victoria, and what it means to really, yes, celebrate a team and trans and gender diverse inclusion in sport. And Talpa's also a presenter on the main FM show on The Wing. And we've spoken about Centrelink Mutual Obligations, the Toll Campaign, Footscray Foot Patrol, as well as the Conspiracy Nation. But thank you so much for joining us here today on the 7th of August, 2025. Don't forget, you can always listen back to our podcasts, and that's 3cr.org.au/Thursday Breakfast. Hope you have a good day. Bye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.